It is great to be here, and after last year, I on the way home, I said to Watto, I said, I'm going to talk to Fred and the boys and see if I can come again, because God had already laid on my heart what I should talk about on the flight home. So I've been sitting on this for a year. So I'm pretty excited about this. And what we might do is I might try to organise some photocopies, if we can, of a couple of key slides that we'll make reference to right through the weekend. So the series is going to be talking about God, men and sexuality. And we're going to talk a little bit about sex, but actually we're going to talk about sexuality, which is much bigger than the whole issue of sex. And in today's world, do we need this more than ever? And I mean, if you're aware of Sunrise this week, did a whole week on promoting marriage equity and same-sex marriage. And we'll get to talk about that another day, because the guys who have been in Big Shed, when they heard me do a presentation on Enough is Enough, I actually went to a whole heap of the research. So let's put Christian morality aside for a moment. Let's just look at straight social science research. Research from the countries that have had it for 10 years says it's a dumb decision. But you know what? The research is not being put on the agenda. Because the moment that you actually put something on the agenda, you get labelled a bigot. Well, I get labelled a bigot, and opinionated, ill-informed, uneducated. I'm in trouble on radio all the time because I tackle all these sort of topics. But I want to give a background for us to understand the bigger picture of sexuality, so that when we actually want to address issues like that, we've actually got a foundation that we're standing on that we're really clear about. And so before I do that, the love of my life, I mentioned yesterday, been married 31 years, and the family's given me the permission to use the middle photo.
That's awesome.
So we're pretty abnormal as a family. I mean, probably pretty normal. So that's the family up there. This photo here, as I mentioned last year, for those who hear it, bit over probably 3.5 years now, narrowly was diagnosed with breast cancer. So we went the whole deal of three surgeries, the removal of her left breast, a reconstruction from tissue of her tummy, and then chemotherapy. And that was the day her hair was falling out. I was in a school with 130 year eight kids, and I rang her at lunchtime, and she said to me, my hair's falling out, Lee's coming over to take it off. And I said, okay. So that night I made a decision I'd take mine off as well. I called it chemo empathy. It got me brownie points at the time. Now she reminds me the quotient of hair loss was insignificant for me compared to her. I was bragging to a few of the Queensland boys last night, and I said, I'm in the good books with the boss lady. Her birthday was recently. And before we got married, her cousin had an MG. And he collected MGs, and so she drove his MG and said, if ever I get another car down the track, I'll get an MG. Well, 31 years later, for her 52nd birthday, we needed another car, so I bought her an MG, all right? So that's the MG there, okay? It's a 1998 MGF. Got it for a steal, $5,700 in Melbourne, $700 to freight it to Queensland. I'm bonus, you know, it's ahead, and personalised number plates, so I'm in the good books. And I got to tell you, what a great little car. I was telling Watto, the first time we went for a drive, she's driving it really cautiously around the roundabouts. I said, no, sweetheart, it's a sports car. When you come into the roundabout, drop it back into second, boot it. Next roundabout, she drops it back into second, boots it. Woo! She says, can I do that again? surf fishing is one of my passions. I didn't catch this one, but Mick, who came fishing with my team for the first time last year, caught that one. We caught five of those at Fraser last year. So they were in the one gutter over 2 days. That's quite amazing. So if someone catches a big fish, even if I don't catch it, I take a photo. Okay. You know.
What is it?
It's a jewfish, a Mulloway jew. All right. So we also pulled out a couple of sharks. A couple of boys went shark fishing. And pulled out a couple of, you know, 7-foot sharks. And so amongst the tail, it was good fun. Fraser Island. I can tell you, Timmy, 8.5 clicks south of the campsite at Dundabarra. Okay. Yeah, okay. Yeah, actually, you could come in handy, Tim. You could take me for a flight and we could suss out all the gutters that got fish in and GPS mark them. Okay. I want you to imagine that you walk into a church on a Sunday morning, family worship. Not just youth worship, but family worship. You know, so you've got the grannies right down to the little tackers. And they walk in the church and you see that sign as they walk in on the projector just like that, sex and God. I want you to discuss with the blokes next to you, what do you think would be the reactions? What do you think would be the comments? What would be the thoughts that are unspoken as people come into church and see those three words in a family worship on a Sunday morning? Go for it. You've got a couple of minutes to talk. Okay, let's have a little bit of feedback. What do you reckon? What would you sort of comments, thoughts, unspoken comments? Someone's pulled a prank on the pastor. Someone's pulled a prank on the pastor. Or they might think, has the pastor gone nuts this week?
No. We need to call a new pastor.
Yeah, we need to call a new pastor.
It'd be filth.
Be filth. And some of the grannies would go, not in the kids, not in the family service, and cover up the kids' eyes and, you know, how dare you put those three words together? Sorry? Where's the pictures? Huey? Hang on. We don't need to know anymore. And it might be the first time that Josh and Huey have got a whole heap of young people sitting next to them in the front row. You know?
Surprise. Be
surprised.
What an interesting sermon today.
What an interesting sermon today. Yeah, I think there would be unspoken. Some people would say, at long last. But a lot of people would feel uncomfortable with going, oh, wow, this is exciting, or long last.
It wouldn't have happened 10 years ago.
Wouldn't have happened 10 years ago. Now, I've asked this question literally of thousands of people around the country. And on the whole, apart from that at long last type one, most of the comments would be negative. There'd be a negative sort of reaction. So the question needs to be asked is, where does this negative reaction come from? And it's a very, very important question. Where did this negative reaction come from? Because if we're actually going to confront it, we actually have to understand this. And Simon says media, and that's part of the picture, but it actually goes back way before that. And if we actually go back to the early church fathers, and particularly now, if you're Protestant, I think you pronounce it Augustine. And if you're a Catholic, you pronounce it Augustine. You know, they pronounce it differently. But whichever way, he was a bloke who was a boozer and a womaniser before he got saved. So before he became the main man by name, he didn't have a really good life. And then he became one of the great early church fathers. But this was his belief. Sex transmits original sin, therefore sex is corrupt. Marriage is a permitted concession to human weakness, because if you were tough and strong, you could be celibate, but those who were weak had to get married. Sex, other than for having children, was sinful. And in fact, Jerome, who came after Augustine, he actually said sex for procreation was okay, but if you enjoyed it, it was a sin. Duh! I go, you know, where did these guys get it from? Now, if you went back to Jewish culture didn't hold this thing that sex was a permitted concession for human weakness. Because in Jewish culture, if you're single, they want to know what's wrong with you. All right, celibacy is not highly valued in Jewish culture. Marriage and family is. So, what drives this early church father's thinking? And we need to understand an attitude about this. And actually where it comes from is a concept called Gnosticism. And the Greek word nous, and some of you young fellows might have heard your grandparents say use a bit of nous, actually literally translates to knowledge or insight. Now, Gnosticism means having a special or secret knowledge. Now, let me give you a little bit of a history, geography lesson for a moment. So, imagine this is Israel here. So you got the Middle East here, the Mediterranean Ocean here. So you got Northern Europe over here. Down here you've got Egypt and Africa, and England's way over here. Now, the early church was praying for a blessing. And I always say, you've got to be careful when you pray for a blessing. Because blessings come in disguises sometimes. So the early church is praying for a blessing. And what happens is, the Jewish Christians get persecuted by the Jews. Their own brothers persecuted them. And what this did was spread Christianity around through to Egypt, into Africa, over what we know as Eastern Europe, and then up around into Northern Europe. That's how the gospel spread around the world, because the blessing on the early church was persecution. I'll give you another example. You know when Jacob wrestled with God all night and he says, I'm not going to let you go until you give me a blessing? And God punches him in the groin and leaves him with a permanent limp. Yeah, we've got to be careful when we pray for blessings. Okay? Because if we really want to be blessed, sometimes God comes in strange ways. And as we heard last night, God throws out a lifeline. And some of the blessing is that he wants to throw a lifeline. But you know what? Shit's going to happen. And that's why we always have battles. Now, when the church started to merge around in Northern Europe, is that it underwent, Christian thinking went under radical difference. Because for a Jew, their thinking is holistic. So spirituality just is part of life. God is the great I am. No one asks the question in Jewish culture, does God exist? Because God is. To say, does God exist, is a dumb question to Jews. Because God is the great I am. Or if you translate, you know, that I am is I be. God is just God. And sexuality is part of whole of life for Jews. Now, this is a profound way of thinking. Next time you're sitting on the toilet, just remind yourself this is a spiritual activity. Because all of life is spiritual. But what we've done is that we've moved into Greek thinking, which is this Northern European type of stuff, where Greeks actually compartmentalized. This part was spiritual, this part's personal, this is it. So they had a different way of thinking. So as Christianity merged into Greek thinking, is that what happened was this thing called Gnosticism emerged, and Paul's letter to the church, the Colossians, in Colossae, the church in Colossae, his letter to the Colossians, is basically to combat Gnosticism. Because what happened was, in Gnosticism it was, well, you know, you're not really saved because you haven't had this special experience or this secret knowledge. So then you have this higher order of Christians and this lower order. Where it plays out in today is the people who are carnal Christians and those who are spirit-filled Christians. That's Gnosticism. It's rife in any Greek-thinking culture. So what happened with the Greek-thinking culture is that when they started to think about sexuality, that their assumption that was human matter, flesh, was alien or anti-spiritual. So therefore what happened was you had to separate this carnal, fleshly stuff from the spiritual. So then what happened was that the stuff of the flesh was carnal and bad and at best to be tolerated. And therefore, sex became part of the flesh and the carnal, which was unspiritual. And then, as a result of Gnosticism, this got tied into gender, so that the higher order of thinking and mind became masculine, and the lower order of the flesh and sexuality became feminine, and therefore sex and Eve was the root of all evil. When I read the Gospels, it's the love of money that's the root of all evil. But that's what happened with the thinking. Is this making sense? So this is very, very important. Just to give you a point here. One historian wrote this. The official position of the church between the 3rd and 10th centuries was that sex was forbidden on Saturdays, Wednesdays and Fridays, as well as during the 40-day fast periods before Easter, Christmas and Whitsuntide, all for religious reasons. When you added up the feast days, the days of female impurity when a woman menstruated, one historian estimates that leaves only 44 days a year for marital sex. What days are that? Very few. Very few. So I go, bummer. All right. Now, as someone who spent 30-odd years looking at the area of sexuality, is that if you take female biology, a woman can only fall pregnant about 4 days in her cycle. So that actually leaves 48 days in a year that she can fall pregnant. So now we've got a theology that matches biology. So what that means then is that sex is only about having babies. And it's not true. It's not true. Now, to complicate this a little bit more, Queen Victoria came to the throne in the 1980s. She was the 18-year-old monarch of the most powerful empire in the world. And the push from Great Britain was to colonise the world and make it, you know, all like British, but also to Christianise the world. They went hand in hand. So early missionaries were often going out and actually trying to change the culture to be more like the empire's culture as well as being Christian. Now, in 1857, Queen Victoria banned, she got the British Parliament to ban any obscene literature because there's this big push for moral purity. Okay, I'll go back one. Oh, I'm ahead of myself. I'll come back to that one. I'll get back to that. So, you know, if you had a picture of the statue of David, you had to draw underpants on him. Because, you know, no boy or girl should know anything about sexuality. There's this push for moral purity. And this is seen in lots of ways. So no girl, no boy, no respectable woman should know anything about sexuality. Now, you may have heard this phrase, but I want to anchor it in history for you. Post-Victorian Prime Minister Mrs. Stanley Baldwin, Prime Minister's wife, her daughter was in India having problems with sex, and she wrote a letter to her mum and said, "How do you do with sexual intercourse?" And her mum said, "Close your eyes and think of Mother England." So it was actually in a letter. Now, you may have heard the phrase, lots of people know it, but it's actually from history. Great advice from a mother to a daughter, isn't it? Really helpful stuff. All right. Now, I'm going to go back to the slide because I missed one here, and I'll come back. Let me tell you that I want to challenge some of this view, because if sex is for procreation, then the only basis that we have for that is two references in the Bible. The first one is with Adam and Eve in Genesis 1:28, where they're told to go and be fruitful. And then after the flood, where God says to Noah and his family, populate the earth. So when you have two references where it's actually really clear that, you know, you're commanded to go and be fruitful. And I want to put this, is that sex produces children is a biological fact. It's got nothing to do with the doctrine of theology. And we need to be really careful about how we confuse facts of physiology with theology. We also need to be careful about how we confuse ideology with theology. Theology comes from the body of teaching of the scriptures. Ideology is a body of beliefs that people have. But what we are really good at doing, and particularly in the church, is we take an ideology and then we actually turn it into theology and we biblicalize it. Now, let me give you an example of this. I attend a Baptist church these days, and we were going to change our leadership structure. And in Baptist church, they have this thing called a diaconate, and we were changing it to a management team. And one lady who was, you know, Baptist before she was born, she got up to speak at the meeting and she said, "We cannot change the name of this leadership because diaconate is biblical." And the hair on the back of my neck stood up. My wife put her hand on my leg and said, "Sit." I am married to such a good woman. She keeps me out of trouble lots of times. All right. And so I sat, and one of the retired pastors in our church, who's a very gracious, far more gracious man than I could ever be, who's also a very good Greek scholar. He shuffled to the front and picked up the microphone and he said, "I'm not the best Greek scholar." And I thought, well, you're the best one we've got in our church. And he said, "To my understanding, in the New Testament, the word diakona exists, which means servants, but there is no word in the New Testament for a body of servants called a diaconate." So he actually challenged her and said, so for her, a diaconate was biblical, but that is actually a structure that became part of her ideology, her body of beliefs, which became part of her theology, which now was part of the Bible for her. And then when we start to discuss things that people believe are part of their theology, it's really hard to shift them. And we have to be really careful about, in the area of sexuality, that we don't confuse those things about our body of beliefs, our ideology, and our theology about which comes from the Bible. Very, very important to be clear about that. Okay? Now, what happened in the Victorian period is that they got it confused. So what did this push for moral purity produce? Well, let me show you this. If you saw Pirates of Caribbean number one, okay, Elizabeth, she's getting dressed for this event, so they put a corset on, and then they tighten it up so she can't breathe, because in that period, shape was bad. So you crush a woman's breasts down so she had no shape. Because if she had shape, some bloke might get turned on. You know, it's just not on. So clothing was neck to knee and to hide shape. If you went to a dinner party and chicken meat was on the menu, you couldn't say leg or breast because somebody might get turned on. If you're going to be proper, you said white meat or dark meat. In some households, you know, because they had that lovely shapely legs, you know, in some households they put little stockings over the legs so the teenage boys wouldn't get aroused. Most doctors at that time, nearly every doctor, probably 99% of doctors were men. So when a woman went to meet a doctor so that it was respectable, he had a mannequin in the corner, she'd sit on the chair and he'd examine the mannequin and she'd go, ooch, ow, ow, as he presses the mannequin. All right? That practice is still alive today in some Islamic countries. All right? Under the guise of being pure and respectable. Now, wet dreams is really, really important. What we know is that every bloke has wet dreams. It's God's way of checking that the plumbing works. All right? But secondly, is what happens is the seminal vesicles, which we've got two, is when they get full, is they trigger a nerve sending to the brain, which actually causes a wet dream. So most wet dreams are not about eroticism or thinking about some babe's cute, all right? It's actually a very sound physiological function to it. Now, you've got to understand the theology at Queen Victoria's time is that what happened is that they had a farming metaphor. So the man contained the seed of life. He planted the seed in the soil of the woman, and if it didn't bear fruit, then the soil was barren. What we know now is that a man ejaculates between 200 and 400 million sperm and it connects with an egg. So one of those connects with the egg and produces a baby. 50, 60% of infertility cases are women's issues, 30 to 40% are men's issues, 10% we don't know. So the barren concept came out of a farming metaphor, but we've got different science today. Now, the reason this is important, because if a young man was having wet dreams or masturbating in his sleep, because they believe wet dreams, he must have been masturbating in his sleep, he's wasting the seed of life. Do you get the concept now? The fact that only one sperm produces a pregnancy and the other 200-400 million die, they didn't know that. So you had to have come up with ways of stopping guys wasting the seed of life. So down here on number A is a basket to keep his hands away from his private bits because, you know, he's playing with himself. The one in the middle is a bit more elaborate. When he got an erection, the manservant would come in with a bucket of water. And the one on the far side, it's called a physical deterrent. Well, there's always guys that go, oh, they go, the joys of an adolescent boy in the Victorian period, hey? Tough. Now, the question has to be, did this push for moral purity by ignorance, not talking about it, produce moral purity? No. In the city of London, the police knew of 8,000 prostitutes working the streets. That's the ones they knew of. In the city of Leeds, there were 41 churches and chapels. At the same time, 451 pubs and 98 brothels. 10 times as many pubs and twice as many brothels. In a time when we're going to go, push for moral purity, push for moral purity, push for moral purity. And so here's the point I want to make. When we don't address it or we try to suppress it, it flourishes. Now, I won't ask the question here, but I'll tell you because I've asked lots of blokes. I estimate of most Aussie blokes, less than 2% of us have had our dads sit down with us and go, this is what you need to know about the facts of life. This is how sex works. This is how you treat a woman. This is what it's about. Less than 2% of Aussie blokes. And we're supposedly a sexually progressive country. And yet we're still not talking about it in a way that's constructive and healthy. No wonder some of the stuff is flourishing in our culture. So, I'm going to talk about sexual theology for a moment. I'm going to make this really simple. The church's sexual theology is what I call the prudish theology. Is what they did was they reduced it down to about bodies. Sex is about bodies. Bodies are bad and evil because of Gnosticism. Therefore, we'll cover it up. We won't talk about it. So sex is a bad thing. And I tell you, in my marriage counselling, I actually have lots of couples, lots of women who come in who go, sex is a gift from God, but yet they have sexual hang-ups. Somehow in their brain, they know it's a gift from God, but somehow in the rest of their body, it doesn't connect. Because we've actually had centuries of this prudish theology. Now, the other end of the spectrum are the pornographers, which are rife in our world. And the top picture there, I was at a men's camp 2 years ago, and at the free time, I jumped on my pushy, and I went for a cycle, about 40k ride. And as I was riding down, I saw this billboard. So when I came past it on the way back, I got off my bike and took a picture. And the book there by Gail Dines is on porn. It's 20 years of research into the porn industry in America. So what we have is that on the other end, which is the world's theology, which is driven by the pornographers, is that it's what I call the risque theology, and they reduce it to bodies as well. But they say, if you've got the right body, if you do the right things, it's good fun. And if you find something that's good, stick to it. And what I want you to get is, do you see what the church's theology on one end has done, and the world's theology has done exactly the same thing? They've reduced sexuality to bodies, but one says it's good and one says it's bad. It's called a reductionist approach. We've reduced sexuality to just being about bodies and whether we're going to see it as good or whether we're going to see it as bad. Now, I'm going to give you an alternative to that today. So, but let me challenge, first of all, some of the views of our society, just very, very quickly about this. All right, first thing is, each society around the world has almost without exception passed on to the next generation physical knowledge about sex, social and moral standards governing sexual behaviour. The one exception is our culture, Western civilization. Nearly every culture in the world has had taught about what is sex, what are the rules around sex, how do we actually understand sex in our culture. Western culture hasn't. Second thing is that I get really ticked off when I hear people saying of teenage boys, they're just a bunch of randy animals, they're going to do it anyway. That is so far from the truth. People who say that have no understanding of human sexuality. Animal sexuality functions completely different to human sexuality. In the animal world, there's about 50 different ways of procreating. And in fact, there's a species of praying mantis that she doesn't need a bloke to procreate, she can procreate on herself. Which is probably good for most of the male praying mantis, because the rest of them, after they have sex, she rips her head off and eats them. That's a good encounter. Not. The second thing is, we talk about proficiency rate. Now, if God wanted to make human sexuality so easy, he could actually have done this, where we have the proficiency rate of the animal kingdom. So what happens in the animal kingdom? When it's time that the woman can fall pregnant of the species, she goes on heat. She ovulates. She sends out a signal. I'm ready, boys. Now imagine this. Woman ovulates, sends out a signal. All the boys pick it up. They're randy as roosters. They have a punch up or a scrap. Last man standing gets there and scores. 99 times out of 100, she falls pregnant. And he walks away and has very little to do with it. Because that's what happens in the animal world most times. But the proficiency rate amongst humans is between 8 and 15%. Because we're actually the only species that has sex for pleasure and puts meaning on our sexual interactions. It is not about biological urge to regenerate the species. Yes, that's part of it. But we actually have a much more complex sexuality than most of the animals. And I've got to tell you, it would have been much easier if God made us like most of the animal kingdom and that we actually didn't have this thing called marriage, relationship and family. Because as some of you blokes know here, there's a lot of heartache when we start to deal with relationships, marriage and family, doesn't it? Some of us have incredible blessing. Some of us have incredible heartache. Because human sexuality is about meaning. And so I say to people this, you know what? God is the one who invented sex, not people. We didn't come up with it. He did. And so there's a huge difference between what our culture sees about sex and what actually the research and the Bible says. Okay, so here you go. I don't expect you to know the answers to this, but you're going to discuss this in a moment. Have a chat about this in a minute. I'm going to put three up and you can choose which ones. So, does the Bible have a negative or positive view about sex and sexuality? What does the Bible say about physical techniques of sexual intercourse within marriage? And then the third one is, what's the Bible say about masturbation? Discuss it with the blokes next week and see what you come up with. Go for it. Okay, in the interest of time, I'm just going to give you some feedback. I'm going to start with the bottom one. Zip. The word masturbation doesn't occur in the Old Testament or New Testament at all. And yet I've heard people talk about the sins of masturbation, and if you masturbate, you'll go blind. I came out of high school and I arrived at university, moved into the residence, and a third year student had a big poster that says, I masturbate regularly and will soon go blind. I thought, welcome to uni. Now, the only hint we get is in Leviticus about 17, which is about ceremonial cleansing. And you have to understand the context. If we went back to Israel about 4,000 years ago, is that what happens is that there were no bathrooms. When a woman menstruates, she didn't have tampons and pads like today. So part of the way of regulating hygiene was that when a woman menstruated, she wasn't allowed to go to worship. So she literally would use rags. So people would have known she was menstruating. And once her menstruation finished, she'd have a ceremonial bath and then go to the temple to worship. Now, in amongst that same bit, there's one little verse that says, if a man gets semen on his bedclothes or on himself, he's ceremonially unclean. Now, it doesn't say whether it gets there by spillage, masturbation, wet dreams. It doesn't say that. So we don't know. So if we're going to be really accurate theologically, is that the Bible is neutral on masturbation. So then we actually have to wrestle with how do we answer that question, yeah?
The Old Testament speaks about a person trying to short-circuit the system by saying he spilled it on the ground.
Yep.
To achieve a purpose of that he didn't impregnate.
Okay, you're talking about Oren, and Oren's sin. People use this for masturbation, but Oren's brother had died without a child, and according to the law, he had to take his brother's wife and have a child in honour of his brother. He didn't like his brother, so what happens is when he's having sex with her, he withdraws before he ejaculates and ejaculates on the ground. Now, the reason he's judged is not because of the ejaculation on the ground, but because he's actually not following God's commands. That's why he's judged. But it's been twisted and used along. But the truth is, the Bible doesn't say anything about masturbation. But yet, how do we come up with a theology of masturbation when the Bible doesn't talk about it? Good question. Let me go to the next one. What does the Bible say about physical techniques of sexual intercourse within marriage? Very little. In the New Testament, and I've got to say, there's about 174 verses that talk about sex in the Bible. All right. And what I can tell you, you will not find one negative verse about sex in the context of marriage. You only find it out of the context of marriage. So the only ones there is in the New Testament is keep the marriage bed pure. The other one says only stop having sex by mutual agreement for the prayer, purpose of prayer and fasting, but make sure you come back and do it. I like that bit. I really like that bit. All right. You betcha. And in Jewish culture, sex was seen as the woman's right, not the man's right. Right? And it was wrong for a man to not meet his wife's needs for cherishing and love, which was seen through sex. Interesting twist. The last one is, what does the Bible have to say, negative or positive? It's technically what we call ambivalent. It's both. And some people go, the Bible's boring. I go, well, you don't read the bits I read. So I'm going to read from Proverbs for you. Proverbs is poetry literature. So back in your school days, you learn about allegory and metaphor, words that represent and paint word pictures. So let me just read a little bit from Proverbs 5. My son, pay attention to my wisdom. Listen well to my words of insight that you may maintain discretion and your lips may preserve knowledge. For the lips of an adulteress drip like honey and her speech is smoother than oil. But in the end, she's bitter as gall, sharp as a double-edged sword. Her feet go down to death and her steps lead straight to the grave. She gives no thought to the way of life. Her paths are crooked, but she knows it not. Then he goes on to say this. Drink water from your own cistern. Now, metaphor. What's he talking about? He's talking about sex here. Have sex with your own wife. Running water from your own wells. Should your springs overflow in the streets? That's a nice picture, isn't it? Your streams of water in the public squares? No! Let them be yours alone, never to be shared with strangers. May the fountain of your youth be blessed. That's a great picture. And may you rejoice in the wife of your youth, a loving doe, a graceful deer. May her breasts satisfy you always. May you ever be captivated by her love. And so my wife said, if you quote that verse to me again, I'm going to hit you with your Bible over the head. As an enthusiastic young man, I go, it's biblical for me to be satisfied with your breasts. I do slip it in occasionally now, okay? Now, let me tell you about Song of Songs for a moment. Most of us don't like Song of Songs because we don't understand it. Song of Songs is poetry, and the poetry metaphor is of the period. It's not unique to that book. There's a whole heap of it. So when you actually look at Song of Songs, you've got to understand a bit of the poetry. So when it talks about gazelle, it's talking about a penis. When it's talking about garden, it's talking about a vagina. When it's talking about a palm tree, it's talking about a woman, and the cluster of palms are the mm-hmm. So now I resort to my wife and go, hey, the gazelle wants to visit the garden. Or I go, can I climb the palm tree and behold the beautiful cluster? So people who say the Bible's boring don't read the bits I read, hey? So the truth is the Bible's got a lot to say about sex that is really positive in the context of marriage. It is only really condemning outside of that context. Now, I want to give you probably the most important passage I want to give you that I use in the area of sexuality. And it's Jesus' words in John 10:10. He says, the thief comes only to steal, to kill, to destroy, and I come that you may have life and have it to the full. In the message it says, the thief is only there to steal, kill, and destroy. I come so that you have real and eternal life, more and better life than you dreamed of. And I say, in the area of sexuality, as in every area, it comes down to two simple decisions. A decision for rip-off or a decision for life. So I actually want to talk about sexuality that is life-giving, not a rip-off. And doesn't our country need this? You bet. So let me give you a different view of sexual theology. So we have the risque, we have the prudish. But in the middle, I want to talk about biblical sexuality or holistic sexuality. And holistic sexuality is about, it involves my body, it involves my mind, it involves my emotions, it involves relationships, and it involves spirituality. Sexuality touches every dimension of my being. Every dimension. Now, this picture up here is one of the pictures I love about sexuality, and there's two faces. It's a young woman's face and a young man's face. The trick is focus on the white. Sort of split it in half and focus on one side on the white, and then focus on the other side to see the young woman, young man. No, it's not upside down. Okay, if you watch this, I'll show you the transition, okay? So if you focus on the white there, there's a young woman's face. The little spiky bit at the top's her hair. You can see her nose poking out. There's her mouth and then her chin. If you watch the transition now, it'll actually go to a young man's face. His hair hanging down, his nose. There's his mouth there, his chin, his chest. And I love this picture because human sexuality, when we engage in sex, it is a complex interaction of dimensions. When I teach this in schools, I talk about five dimensions of being. And I say that in our complexity, I'm trying to help us understand. So we use being as a way of understanding this. B stands for body, so I'm a physical being. And there is a physical aspect to sexuality. There's a whole heap of hormones and chemicals in our body. There's sexual pleasure. There's gratification, a whole heap of stuff. But there's also, E is emotional, which is there's an emotional aspect to our being. We all have feelings. And a generation ago of Lutheran men didn't have feelings. Well, they thought they didn't. Because they weren't taught how to deal with their feelings. Because they perceived their feelings made them weak. Whereas in fact, our feelings make us strong. There's intellectual. So sex involves my mind. And every bloke has some struggle with this because fantasy is the mind aspect of sexuality. But we don't talk about how do we cultivate healthy and godly fantasies. We don't actually talk about how do we manage ungodly and unhealthy fantasies. We just don't go there and talk about it. But that's actually of the mind. And we cannot escape it. And as blokes, it takes less than a third of a second to put a visual image on our brain that's imprinted on our brain for the rest of our life that we can't eradicate. And we live in a world that uses sex to sell everything right through to porn that is just horrible. And you get exposed to that, bang, it's in your brain. And it pops in our head all the time, especially when we don't want it to. But we don't talk about this much. Then N is for neighbour. So that's about being a social relational being. And one of the biggest myths that I like to tackle at the moment, this whole thing about friends with benefits. What a heap of crap that is. And the last one is God, which is the spiritual dimensions of being. And this is not necessarily Christian. Eastern mysticism has got a lot to say about spirituality of sex. And every bloke in Australia is a spiritual being. Just many don't know it. Watch them at the footy, you see how spiritual they are. So I say that what happens is that sexuality and sex in marriage is an interaction of five dimensions of being with me, with my wife, meshing together at five dimensions. And the world's leading marital sex therapist, Dr. David Snarch, he says electric sex, he calls it wall socket sex, all right, is when you link those other four dimensions with your genitals. Where you link your brain, you link your heart, you link your spirit with another person. And I said last year, just in a passing comment, that the best sex happens probably when you've been married 20, 30, 40 years, is because you've actually started to learn how to link those other things. All right? The best sex happens when you've been married 30 or 40 years, 20, 30, 40 years, because what happens is you move from focusing on to bodies and you start to link these other dimensions. And when you look at your wife, you connect with her with your emotions, with your mind, with your relationship, with your spirituality, and then sex becomes something profound. That's why it's the best sex later on. You betcha.
Yeah, it's
not about giving. And it's not about serving.
Yeah, it's about what can I get from you? Mutual, helping each other out type thing as opposed to learning to love, growing to love.
And it takes probably 20 years to learn that for most of us. So, let me just quickly go to Jesus' ex. Really a couple of importance. One, Jesus never isolates sexual sin for special condemnation. Never. And in fact, the first person that Jesus shared that he was the Messiah with was a half-caste woman at a well who was socially isolated because she had been married five times and was living with a bloke. And that's the person Jesus tells first that he's the Messiah. How cool is that? And he looks at her and he has this conversation about drinking water and he looks at her and in the eyes and he says, "Sister, I see you're really thirsty, but you're drinking in the wrong place. You've been married five times, you're living with a bloke, and you're still thirsty." And she goes, "Wow, I see you're a prophet." And he says, "More than a prophet, I'm the Messiah." How cool is that?
Wouldn't you think that the guy, if that happened,
Yeah, she would. She wouldn't say he's a prophet. But I know there's some that who would, because it's in the eyes that you look with and what they see back, all right? Jesus criticizes sexual misuse and abuse always in the context of other sins. Greed, gluttony. Always in the context of other sins. And he didn't make an issue of sex except for once. His only teaching about sex was in Matthew 5, which is the Sermon on the Mount following the Beatitudes, is the only time that he actually specifically taught on sex. All his interactions on sex was a response to questions from the disciples or others. So they asked a question, he responded. Only once did he go, this is what you need to know about sex. And that particular passage, I'm just going to read it to you in the Message, because the Message has got a good translation of it. And Jesus says this, you know the next commandment pretty well. Don't go to bed with another man's spouse. But don't think you persevered your virtue simply by staying out of bed. Your heart can be corrupted by lust even quicker than your body. Those leering looks you think nobody notices, they also corrupt. So he's got some really great teaching around just in that one passage. So, what I want to give you here, and this is maybe one of the things that I'll copy, because I'm going to come back to this at every session, main session that I do. I just need to get my notes up here. Balswick and Balswick are a husband and wife team who are professors at Fuller Theological Seminary in Pasadena. And they wrote this book because there weren't many good Christian books on sex. And I've read most of them, and I've got to tell you, there's a lot of them not worth the paper they're printed on. And they came up with 6 principles that lead to authentic sexuality based on the Bible. The first one is this, is that human sexuality is established in the differentiation between male and female and the unity established between them. What he's saying is, we see God's sexuality in our separateness as blokes and women and in our connectedness in our relationships. It's not one or the other, it's both. Separateness and connectedness. Now, if you hold this to the Trinity is connected but separate. It's a mystery. And sex reflects the Trinity. Second principle, they say, sexuality is a good gift meant to draw persons to deeper levels of knowing themselves, knowing others, and knowing God. Sex is not just about pleasure. It's actually about knowing me, knowing the other, and knowing God. The third one, humans are born with an innate capacity for sexual pleasure, and human sexuality can best develop within the emotional, caring, and trustworthy family environment. Little boys in the womb have the capacity for an erection. Do they understand sex? No, they don't. But sexual pleasure is just there. And when little boys are playing with themselves in the bath and mum's freaking out thinking her son's going to be a pervert, and I go, no, he's just doing it because it feels good. He has no meaning on that other than it feels good. But don't impose an adult meaning that's not going to be helpful. And how do you teach them to develop a sense of their being, their masculinity, their sexuality, in a way that's going to be really productive? The fourth one. Sexuality and spirituality are intricately connected. And I added this bit in. Sex is a metaphor for the mystical union that exists between Christ and his church. Paul says, when he talks about husbands and wives, he says, I'm talking about Christ and the church, but it's a profound mystery. So there's this parallel between Christ and the church and husbands and wives. And I've got to tell you, I can't get my head around it. It is a profound mystery. But there is something profoundly spiritual about sexuality. Now, one of the struggles is, when our sexual awakening happens in puberty, you can see a lot of young people go off the rails and leave the church. Because if the devil can mess them up in their sexuality, then he messes them up with their spirituality. Because these two are really closely together. Sexuality and spirituality are really closely linked. And isn't it a shame that we haven't talked about enough of this in the church? When it's so important. After the fall, sexuality became distorted and is in need of redemption. 6, Christ offers restoration and renews our potential for authentic sexuality. God wants to save our souls. He wants to save our whole being. And this is a PJ bit that I added in here. The Bible does not address every aspect of human sexuality, but it does give principles that can be applied to the complex questions of human sexuality. If you want to go to the Bible for answer every question, you won't find answers for every question. But there are principles that can be applied to answer those complex questions. So, I was going to leave a time for questions, but what I might do is, I'll give a bit more time later on. What I want to do, are there any burning questions? Let me stay with this one for a moment. Any burning questions? A clarification. Yep. Okay. The temple prostitutes weren't the Christians. They were actually the pagan. The question was about Paul and the Corinthians getting messed up. And in Corinth, they had pagan worship of, and they had temple prostitutes. It was very common in Greek culture. And so what happens was is that in the mix-up is that some people tried to actually integrate some of their religion of their culture with this new teaching of Jesus. And that was where it got messed up, because you had these people where going to have sex with the temple prostitute was considered worship. Now you actually got this radical new teaching saying, hang on a minute, that's wrong. And so people were messed with their heads and going, how do I fit that? The temple prostitutes of today, right, is prostitution and pornography. And lots of guys get messed up with that. Good guys who love God, loves their wives, and they go, but I keep going back to this stuff. Because what's happened is that their head's a bit messed up. And so the Corinthians were messed up in the head because of the practices of the church, of the religion of the church, of the culture, and this new church of the way of Jesus emerging. Does that help? So he was trying to address that conflict and help them to get it sorted. All right? Any other burning questions? Okay. This is what I reckon I've got here for you to think about. And I'm going to put it up, and if you've got... take a note, or if you've got your camera, your phone there, you can take a picture of this for discussion. So I want you to reflect on this. What stood out for me most from the session? And you can, if you want to do this in your quads, you can do that. Second one is, what is my sexual theology and beliefs, and where have they come from, and what's shaped them? You know, on the risque, prudish, holistic, which end do I tend to go for, and what's shaped it for me? And the third one is, what influence has this had on my life? Has it resulted in righteousness and grace, or has it resulted in fear and shame? Now, that's a pretty confronting question. But if you feel comfortable sharing that with your quad or somebody, I want to encourage you to think about what's going on for me in this session. Where do I sort of fit? And not where do I want to be, but where have I stood? Because I got to tell you, I grew up very much on the prudish theology. Very much on the prudish. And when I rejected the church, I went to the other extreme. And then coming back to the church and coming back to knowing the Creator, is that then I actually spent a long time trying to sort out what this middle ground was and how did it look. Because I went from one extreme to the other extreme, which we often do. And so a chance to just to process that. Now I'm going to be building on this. I just want to give, first of all, a platform of where we've come from in our thinking and why we have issues with our understanding of this, because we've been messed up by the early church fathers. Does it make sense?
Yep. You know where my sexual education first came from? Was smoking guns at school.
Yep. And still today, kids get their education predominantly from their friends and their mates and literature rather than from their parents. Okay? And, hey, I talk about this stuff on radio. I talk about this stuff, like, here around the country. I'm 53, got two adult daughters, and my dad still can't say the word sex in front of me. And I go, you think I know something about it, Dad? He's 86, and he still can't say sex and look me in the eyes. Right? And I respect that for where it comes from, but, hey, that's a deficit. And then my mum tried to talk to me about it, and no mum should talk to her son about it. Right, that's just wrong. Okay, it needs a dad to talk about it, or a dad substitute. This is part of men's business. And that's why I'm talking about this, because we have got a lot of business to do in this area. within our families, within our churches, within our country. Okay, that's why we're talking about this. Yep. There's a time when mum and dad should talk with all the kids. So mum and dad should talk to a daughter because the dad should tell them about some truths about blokes, okay? And mum needs to tell them some stuff too, okay? But then there's some stuff that's men's business, some stuff that's women's business. So for my daughters, you know, they were told, sorry, if you wear that, let me tell you, guys' sex drive is visually orientated. They get turned on that quick. That sends a message. What message do you want to send to them? Okay? And my girls are very modest. And my youngest, for her 22nd birthday, for her party, she had a cocktail dress which came halfway between her knee and, you know, it was very appropriate. It was very appropriate. And she said, what do you think, Dad? And I said, too short, should be a Hessian bag. Her standard reply is, you're lame, Dad. And I go, thanks for the compliment. I'm a dad. I'm supposed to be lame. Okay? But she's gorgeous. But they're really, really responsible. And they talk. I listen to my girls when they're watching their friends on Facebook and go, look what they're wearing. Boy, they're setting themselves up trouble because what we wear tells a story. So I talk to my daughters about what story do they want to be known by. It's so simple. So there's a time for mum and dad to talk to their sons and daughters, but there's some stuff that is dad business, some stuff that is women's business for the daughters. Watto?
Peter, a lot of our young men have fathers.
Yep.
And I tell them, no excuse,
get yourself a spiritual father. You betcha. Yeah, I'm going to talk a bit more about that later, but in Being a Bloke, there's a whole chapter on community of men, and we talked about that last year. That a boy becomes a man because he's part of a community of men, which his father's part of. Now, when there's no dad, you can still be part of a community of men. My dad was an absent dad. I know he loves me. He's only told me once in my life. I love him, but he's been an absent dad. But the men in my life who have been part of my community of men in the journey of my life have filled the gap. So this is so important because more than ever, we have a generation of young men screaming and crying for a community of men to fill the gap. And when this is sexuality issue, is part of where we have to fill the gap. So we need to do it for ourselves, we need to do it for our sons, and then we need to do it for the boys in our congregations and in the community who have absent dads. All right, so that's why this is a really important topic, and that's why I've been sitting on this for a year, really excited about this, because this is really important stuff. Okay, so all I've done is just tried to lay a foundation. So what I want to suggest... Another question.
Continuing on with what's been business for women's business.
Yep.
I'm a boy and a girl.
Yep.
Now, with my daughter, there is no mother with me.
Yep. Yep.
Is it appropriate then, my partner, we don't live together, but my partner has a good relationship
yep.
with my daughter, that she takes that role?
Yep, it will. And you might say to her, just be mindful that a mum's not going to talk about this and look for if the opportunity comes. So what we've got to do is we've got to look for incidental teaching moments. They're the things that pop up left field where you go, here's the moment. Okay? My wife said to me, you're the one who talks about sex, you can talk to the girls. And I said, it's mum's business. Now, the girls were nearly 7 and 10, and they were going up to get a birth certificate because Nerilee's adopted. And they said, how come you're adopted? And that led to whole talking about sexuality, relationships. And Katie came home, and she said, Dad, we talked about periods. In a few years' time, how gross is that? But it happened in the car, driving into the city to get a birth certificate. And how appropriate is that? Remember that thing that sexuality is best nurtured and developed in a loving, trustworthy family? Incidental moments will come. But for those who are single dads, is that the women in our life, whether it's our partners, whether it's our sisters, whether it's our mum, their grandmum, there are people who can step the gap. If we go, can you be mindful of this, please? We don't orchestrate it. We just invite them to be mindful about it. Okay? The web page, I just always put that up, and you want to follow on Facebook, that's there. I'm going to put the reflections back up. I'm going to pray. Father God, I want to say thank you that sex and sexuality is your idea and not ours. And I want to say thank you that it is an awesome gift. And Lord, I've got to say I love that gift. But Lord, the devil knows how to take it and mess with it. And in messing with it, he messes us up with it. And I know I've been messed up. But I thank you that the power of your son Jesus is that you're in the business of putting stuff right, including in sex and sexuality. And I want to say thank you for that. Lord, I want to pray for my brothers here that as they start to reflect and ponder and discuss, open up the right areas to talk about so that we can be changed and become better blokes. And not just better blokes for our benefit, but better blokes for our families, for our churches, for our communities, and for this great land of ours. Holy Spirit, we invite you to guide our thoughts and discussion for this time of reflection. Pray it in your precious name, Jesus. Amen.